to Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 277th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 276 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So once again, that's www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. I've been away from this mic for 2 weeks, but I'm now back with some great guests lined up beginning tonight. I hope you'll join me next week at the same time for my interview with poet, teacher, and founder of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center, Margot Sriva. Before beginning tonight's conversations, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday night is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6th in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So June's meeting will be this next Wednesday at coffee time on 6N in the Red Mill Shopping Center of Mahopac. The longtime member of that group and of the Mahopac and Yorktown poetry workshops, Terry Dugan, will read her poetry at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, June 11th, at the famous Curly's Diner of 62 West Park Place in Stanford. The number there is 203-348-2020. The June meeting of the aforementioned Mahopac Poetry Group is the very next night, June 12th, at 6:30 in Mahopac Library. It is a group of experienced and fledgling poets, and then if you should like to read, please bring 10 copies of your poem to share. There is, however, no pressure to read. 2 weeks later, on June 16th, the Yorktown Poetry Workshop meets at 6 p.m. At the John C. Hart Library in Sherbrooke, New York, and the same guidelines apply. Finally, on June 21st, there will be the monthly open mic at 7 p.m. at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Philipsy Manor train station in Sleepy Hollow, New York. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 277th in the series. Tonight, I am joined by Priscilla Stevens Goldfarb, writer, poet in spite of herself, a Peace Corps veteran, a member of all the writers' groups that I mentioned earlier, and a close friend. You will note during my conversation with her that Priscilla is constantly playing down her talent. She is wrong. Our listeners wishing to join Priscilla and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Priscilla, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure and a real honor to be on the show with you. Thank you for having me.
I don't know why it should be an honor, but would you start us off with a poem?
I will do that. I don't really title my poems, but I'm going to call this one by its first line, "What Would You Do?" What would you do if it was really him by the tree down at the bottom of your garden? The first time you noticed, he was like some louche guy hunched in the seedy doorframe of a James M. Cain novel. Maybe the postman always rings twice. A shadow, a presence that could bode ill or worse, or even worse than that. Sometimes you checked to be sure and other times not, until one day you realized he was gone. That other guy took his place, the one that sometimes hovered like a guardian angel or some other kind of protector, or lurked like a private eye, too clumsy to conceal he was tailing you, or maybe he wanted you to know so he would throw you off balance and catch you not recycling junk mail, or maybe even smiling. But it wasn't him. It was just a tree that looks like a man. A tree. So smile until tears flow and even dance a little, or whistle a tune while you do the dishes and laugh at yourself when you pour OJ on your cereal. There's no one to see or hear, no man, not even down at the bottom of your garden.
Wow, that is terrific. I've heard it before, but I like it just as much now. Before getting into your story, your own story, I remember that you had very interesting and talented parents. Could you tell us a little about them?
My parents were, my dad was from Connecticut, and he was involved in radio and broadcasting, and he ultimately became the owner and manager of WGCH, a local radio station, and that had been his lifelong dream, and he loved that. He loved community radio, and he really built that station into a wonderful community station. My mom was from the Midwest, from outside of Chicago. And she was what was then referred to as a stay-at-home mom during the years that my siblings and I were growing up. And after we were out of the house and not long after my father died, she ended up running for office, and she served two terms in the Connecticut State Assembly. So she had some. They both had some very interesting times and interesting experiences, and they were great role models.
Well, it obviously worked for them. Staying with the family, you have a son who may or may not be on television tonight. Please tell us why there is a possibility that he will be.
He's my youngest son is an actor and a writer. And he's currently in a production of Beetlejuice, a musical on Broadway, and it's been nominated for 8 Tony Awards, so he's going to be in one of the numbers tonight during the Tony Awards ceremony.
Wow. Okay, finally, on to you. Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Connecticut, and I was born in New Haven, actually, and lived on Long Island briefly, and then moved back to Connecticut when I was in the first grade, and went to a wonderful elementary school. I still remember it quite fondly. I had a great education there, and it was a relatively small school, and the teachers were wonderful. One of the things I remember most about my early education was memorizing poetry in the fifth grade. I can still remember some of the poems word for word that I memorized that long ago.
Wow. Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
You know, I never aspired to anything specific as a young child. I read a lot. I loved to read, and I loved reading about, I loved exploring people and places through reading. And so I knew I always wanted to travel and have adventures in the world. That I aspired, I guess, to be a world traveler and an adventurer, and also to be in charge of my own destiny. In whatever field that might happen to be.
How about your high school years? Where'd you go, and did you write for a school paper or anything while in high school?
I really didn't do much writing in school at all. I went to public high school for 2 years, and then I went for 2 years to a private school in my town. And I had wonderful, wonderful writing teacher, Miss Fayetta McCowan. I still remember her. Every Monday morning of my senior year, I had to hand in a 10-page paper. My classmates and I had to hand in a 10-page paper. And it really forced me to think and work at trying to express ideas clearly and coherently. It was very good grounding, as I ended up doing a lot of expository writing later on.
And what happened after high school?
After high school, I went to Wheaton College in Massachusetts. I majored in European history. I honestly don't remember doing a lot of writing there. I must have had to take some kind of English course. I have no recollection of it. I certainly wrote plenty of term papers. But I had also another very good experience there. Sorry.
That's okay. Did you plan on pursuing history academically or teaching
no,
as a career?
No, I really didn't. I didn't really know what I wanted to do after college, and I didn't view my major. My major was really just because there were some interesting courses and interesting professors that I wanted to study with, and that's how I ended up in European history. It could have been another subject, except possibly for one of the sciences at which I never particularly excelled. But when I graduated from college, I still had no idea of what I wanted to do. And bear in mind, this was back in an era when I had classmates, some of whom were married before they graduated from college, and not all women were thinking about going on to careers. I knew that I wanted to do something. I didn't know what it was. And so I thought that I could at least do something useful and helpful in the world while I figured out what I might want to do. So I ended up joining the Peace Corps.
In a very small sampling, I know three people who were Peace Corps volunteers. You, Jim Casey's wife Barbara, who was in Brazil, and the coordinator of a MAIPAC poetry workshop, Dan Grau, who was also near the equator in Africa. What was your motivation in going that route? Do you remember?
Well, you know, we didn't get to choose where we would serve. I was posted to Uganda. And in those days, it was the early days of Peace Corps, and they had all sorts of exams you had to take when they would decide whether you were fit to go, actually, and whether you had a talent for learning other languages, whether you were going to be able to survive in conditions that were not optimal always. And I thought it would be really interesting to see another part of the world and be doing some good at the same time. So I ended up being posted to Uganda, and I was a teacher there in a secondary school for 2 years.
Where did you get your Peace Corps training?
We did our training at Columbia, at Teachers College. And,
oh, okay.
There had been a program out of
Peace Corps. The reason I ask that is Barbara McMullen remembers all sorts of people being trained at Penn State when she was there, and she used to eat in the same cafeteria with all the Peace Corps volunteers.
Peace Corps used to have agreements with many universities in terms of doing the training. I believe, again, this was early years. This was the fall of 1965, and Teachers College Columbia had already had a program in East Africa called Teachers for East Africa. So they had folks who had actually been in Kenya. I'm not sure if it was Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, but they had been teaching and having that experience of living in the East African area. So they were available, and I guess Peace Corps thought they would be optimal for training us to go over there.
What language was spoken there, and did you have a hard time with it?
Swahili is the lingua franca of East Africa, and we were trained in Swahili before we went over. The group that I trained in, 40 of us were going to Uganda, and the other 100 and I don't know, it was maybe about 120, were going to Kenya. So we all learned Swahili. When I got to Uganda, the area that I was posted to, people understood Swahili, but they didn't really speak it. They spoke Luganda. So I had a really good grounding in Swahili, and I was able to pick up a little bit of Luganda. But English was the official language of the country of Uganda, and that's what the school wanted the kids to learn how to speak. So I mostly, in the school setting, was speaking English.
What these number of years later do you bring back with you from your experiences there?
There's so much that it's difficult to know where to begin. Peace Corps really was a life-changing experience, living in a different culture and coming to understand how different and yet how similar people are. I remember really the kindness and the welcoming attitude of the folks that I met in the village where my school was. And I remember how inspired they were by the fact that Peace Corps volunteers were coming over to teach them. This was in the years when every home, no matter how humble over there, had a picture of John Kennedy. He was a hero at that time in Africa because of his interest and because of sending Peace Corps over. So I remember being very inspired also by the attitude of my students who really wanted to work hard and become successful in their lives and do something in their lives. So I remember, it's the people really that I remember the most, I think. There are other things too.
How much of it changed, do you think, in the Idi Amin years?
A lot changed. I was there immediately post-independence, and there was a pervasive optimism, and there was a lot of money flowing into the country, and there was universal free primary education. Really wonderful things were happening, and everybody felt this was the beginning of the country moving forward and doing some great things. I went back to Uganda for the first time since my Peace Corps days in 2002, and I found that it was a very different place there because of the troubles that they had had under Idi Amin. But the people were still the same kind, generous, warm, wonderful people, and the students that I encountered were absolutely motivated to move forward. So I had the feeling that although people had been through hard times, they had endured, and they were going to come through it.
Now, does the Peace Corps still have the presence in Uganda?
Yes, they do. They were pulled out for several years, but they went back. I'm trying to think exactly what year they went back. I think it would have been around 2007 or 2008. They'd been out since Idi Amin. And so, yes, they are back. And they have a range of programs there, as they do in most countries, different programs in different countries, but education, health care, agriculture, commerce, a real range of community development.
You also learned to ride the motorcycle. Did you continue riding back in the U.S.?
I did not. That Norton 750 was relegated to my Uganda years. I haven't ridden a motorcycle since.
A big bike. Yeah, I rode motorcycles for years up and down the West Side Highway, and then a big bike. And Bob used to ride behind me, and then I came across a scooter, and when she saw that, she was interested because A, it's automatic transmission, and you don't have to shift, and your legs are on the seat rather than wrapped around. So my bikes ran away from her. So then I eventually downsized to a scooter. And then she stopped riding scooters, and I have two of them that I ride. So.
Do you still ride them?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. The cars are bigger and faster now. I don't know if I would feel as safe. When I learned to ride a motorcycle, I was on a back road, dirt roads, in the back country of Uganda.
Well, I've taken it to the riders group and to other things over the years. So, but I don't have them back on the road yet. Hopefully, they will be next week. Now, what did you do when you returned to the United States?
When I came back to the States, the first job I had was as a teacher in the South Bronx. I was teaching at a junior high school, and it was quite a change from where I had been teaching in Uganda. In Uganda, when you walked into a classroom, the students stood up and said good morning, and they were rather formal. In the South Bronx, it was quite a bit less formal, and it was a very challenging group. I loved it. I thought the kids were great, and I had a wonderful time with them. And they worked. That age kid is wonderful to teach because they'll get excited about things and really just follow you anywhere. They're not blasé as they get to be when they're a little older in schools over here. But that was a wonderful job. I loved it, and I was there for about 3.5, maybe 4 years. And it was difficult, though. It was challenging, and I really felt that the teachers were being asked to deal with issues that teachers are not really equipped to deal with. They were societal issues and community issues. And so I decided that I wanted to try to do something else after that.
So what did you wind up doing then?
I ended up going to graduate school in urban planning at Columbia University, thinking I would go into that as a field, as a profession. And that was a very interesting training.
It also had some architecture courses there also, didn't it,
The School of Urban Planning, at Columbia, it's called the School of Architecture and Urban Planning. So the classes are all held at the School of Architecture. I also took a few classes at the law school in planning law and contemplated briefly becoming an attorney.
And did you actually, after going to school there, pursue that as an education or urban planning?
You know, I didn't do that. I had a hiatus because while I was there, during the time I was there, actually before I started there, I had gotten married and started having a family. I was pregnant with our first child as I was finishing my courses at Columbia, and I ended up working on a project in Tunisia while I was pregnant with our first child. It was a hospital feasibility study in Tunisia, a joint project between Project Hope and the Tunisian government and Columbia School of Public Health, actually, and urban and architecture and urban planning. And when I came back, I worked briefly for one of my professors, but once our first child was born, I decided I wanted to stay home with him for a while. And we ended up then having two more in rapid succession. So I ended up staying home until the youngest was in full-time school.
And then what did you wind up doing?
Then I went back to work locally. I wanted to do something where I could still be around and be available for the kids. And I started at a hospice organization. It was a community-based organization that was looking to start a hospice program. And I became very interested in this whole area of hospice and hospice care. So I was the director of that program for a while. And ultimately, during the time I was there, we ended up starting the first certified hospice program on Long Island by joining forces with Visiting Nurse Association of Long Island. And that hospice program, I'm happy to say, is thriving today.
Now, were you living in Manhattan or on the island?
No, living on the island. We had moved out to Port Washington, Long Island. So that's where we raised our kids.
And then how did you get up here?
Well, before I got up here, I had worked at two other places on Long Island. And then at a certain point, as my husband and I were getting older, we started thinking about, you know, if we were going to retire, were we going to want to move somewhere else? The kids were just about out of the house. And we thought we would just try living in a different venue. We had lived in the city when we first got married. And so we thought we'd try the country. So we drew a circle around Manhattan to see how far out we could get and still be able to commute to jobs, and ended up here in Putnam County.
Now, since you've been here, you also got extremely active in local things like the Northern Westchester Hospital Foundation, the Library Association. How did you immerse yourself in all of the local things?
When we moved up here, I could no longer commute to Long Island where my job had been. So I worked first at Columbia School of Public Health, which was an easy commute by car. And then I was recruited to work for another organization, which was right in Midtown Manhattan, which was an easy commute by train. That was an organization called AMREF, Health Africa, which took me really back to my Peace Corps roots. The organization was headquartered in Nairobi. I was head of the U.S. affiliate of this organization. And I stayed with them until I was recruited to Northern Westchester Hospital Foundation, where I stayed for a few years until I retired.
But after you retired, you also got very involved in community things also.
Yes,
tell us about.
I did. But that was mainly my real involvement up here has happened since, I would say, about 2014. I've been involved with the local chorale, the Taconic Chorale. I've sung with them probably for about 15 years. But the other more hyper-local, if you want to call it that, the Phillipstown Community Congress and the Mid-Hudson Library System Board just came about serendipitously, I mean, through talking with someone and things, one thing just led to another. I didn't actively seek them out, but they kind of came to me, and they're interesting, and I've enjoyed being involved with them.
One interesting thing from your resume that I didn't know anything about, what is the FEMA connection?
After I retired, I retired in the summer of 2005, which was the year of Hurricane Katrina. Peace Corps has a program which is now called Peace Corps Response, in which they keep a database of Peace Corps volunteers who choose to be on the database and who would be interested in serving on a short-term assignment. A normal Peace Corps assignment is 2 years, but Peace Corps Response assignments could be anywhere from 2 or 3 months to 8 or 9 months or maybe a year or more, but a shorter term assignment generally. And I had been on that list, but I'd never been able to go because I'd never been able to coordinate it with my full-time job. And after Katrina, every government agency was required to provide workers to help FEMA. And the way Peace Corps fulfilled their responsibility was by calling on the folks that were on their database. And so I got an email in early September. It must have been a week or two after Katrina. I responded to it, and about 48 hours later, I was on a plane down to Orlando, Florida for training, and then I was posted in Alabama at a FEMA recovery disaster resource and recovery center is what they called them then. And that was really very interesting. I never thought I always thought of government as being very bureaucratic, and I never thought I would be able to work within government. But in fact, I ended up working with some of the brightest, most dedicated, wonderful people I've ever worked with in my life at this FEMA center, and it inspired me to then apply to become a reservist, which is exactly what it sounds like. You're on reserve, and when FEMA needs you, when they have multiple disasters, which there are frequently multiple disasters at any given time, they're not all huge disasters. You know, that it could be tornadoes that have been particularly destructive. It's not necessarily anything as big as Katrina. But then they call on you if you're a reservist. And so I worked a couple of disasters as a reservist.
Where were they? Were they local?
Yes, they were local. I worked in Queens. That had been tornado touchdowns. I can't remember exactly the year. I want to say it was maybe 2012. And so I stayed down there and worked on that disaster. And then another one was up in Albany. That was at what's called a joint field office. I was not out in the field, but I was working in a more centralized setting.
Now, during all this time, in addition to you getting involved in various writing groups here, you've been involved in the research project about the late World War II pilot. Could you tell us that story, what you're doing, some of the pitfalls and some of the good things along the way in this project?
John, it's a long story, so you're going to have to interrupt me if it gets to be too much of a Shaggy Dog story.
Okay.
My husband and I were traveling in England in 2009 and in a part of the country we didn't normally travel in, and we came across an American flag by the side of the road, and I was curious to know what it was, and it turned out to be a small plot with a plaque and the name of an American pilot, a bomber pilot, part of the heavy bombardment of Europe prior to D-Day. And this young man, 24 years old, from Minneapolis, had been shot up on a bombing mission, and he managed to get back across the channel, and his plane was on one engine. It burst into flames. He was able to get his entire crew out. They jumped to safety, and he crash-landed and died on impact, trying to avoid the little village nearby. I was quite taken by this, and with the little information I had, I decided I would try to find out more about him. Who was he? Where did he come from? What made him this kind of man that he was to be able to fly this kind of mission and take care of his crew and try to avoid the village, and then ended up losing his own life? And so it became a bit of a mission for me to find out more about him. And starting, I'd say, within a year or two after that, I had a little help because I found out that the contact for the 447th Bomb Group, of which he was a part, that was part of the 8th Army Air Force, the contact for the 447th Bomb Group is a woman that I had been singing with for over 10 years in the Taconic Corral. So that was kind of a coincidence. When I found that, I felt like somebody was tapping me on the shoulder saying, you have to pursue this story and write it. So I've been gathering information over the years and trying to put it together, and that's actually what brought me into writing. I took a writing class so I could learn how to write, and one thing led to another, and I'm still working on that on the story.
You also were able to track the family down with or some information from the Minnesota Library, weren't you? That forwarded to you.
I got information from the Minnesota Library, but how I tracked down the family was a kind of an interesting story. I had given up trying to find a William Johnson in Minneapolis. It would be like trying to find John Smith in Manhattan. And so I decided, instead of trying to find William Johnson and his family in Minneapolis, or obviously not him because he perished in the crash, I decided I would take a completely different tack. And I made a cold call to a realtor in the part of England where his plane had crashed, thinking I would just get information about the area, about the crash, see if there were any local accounts, and just forget about trying to find the family for a while because it had been one dead end after another. So I made a cold call to this realtor, and the person who answered the phone didn't know anything, but he put me on to somebody else who also didn't know anything, but said there was a guy that had been sitting in the pub when two Americans came looking for where their relative's plane had crashed, and he put me in touch with that guy, and that guy in Kent, in England, was the person who put me in touch with my pilot's family back in Minnesota. And that was quite an exciting moment because I was able to meet my pilot's sister before she died and talk with her. She's one of only two people who knew him that I've been able to speak to. Everyone else is gone. All of his crewmates were gone.
And what was the story that I'm a bit hazy about on a library this sending some videotape to another library?
Yes.
And
well,
then
they sent, I had reached out to get some materials, and I reached out through my library, which is in Garrison, the Desmond Fish Library. They had to request the materials from the Minnesota History Museum, which is actually it was through the Minnesota Public Library. And they reached out on my behalf, and what came back was microfilm. And our library doesn't have a microfilm reader. I don't think very many libraries do have microfilm readers anymore. So I ended up over at Mahopac Library, which did have at that time, I don't know if they still do, have a microfilm reader. So I was helped by multiple libraries.
Now, how much have you found out about this fellow's life before he went to the Air Force, and also to what you talked about, what led him to give his life up for other people? What did his sister tell you about his previous life and his character?
A lot of what I found out about him came not just from his sister, but from diaries of his crewmates, which his sister's son sent to me. After I had met with her, he sent me a whole box full of materials, and in them were letters, there was correspondence, there was a whole range of materials, everything from a letter from Secretary of War Henry Stimson posthumously awarding him the Purple Heart, and all kinds of materials, including diaries of his crew, newspaper clippings, photographs, and so on. And I was able to piece together a fair amount from that. There was a war correspondent by the name of Gordon Gammack who interviewed Bill Johnson the day before he was killed. And he wrote a very interesting piece. And there, I found another article by a writer named Brenda Yulin. She was a journalist in Minnesota. She's written a book about writing that I think is fairly well known. I don't remember the name of it. And she wrote about encountering him quite by accident at the home of a friend, and she said a few things about him that gave me some thoughts about his character. He was very loved and respected by his crew. That came through in everything I read about him and by people who dealt with him.
So you've gotten all this information over the number of years. What keeps driving you to get this book out?
You're calling it a book, and I don't see this as a book. This is a short piece about my journey to find this person and to give a little life, a little additional life to him so that he's remembered, because I think it's very important that we learn these stories, that we tell them, and that we remember them. My idea, what's been driving me, is to pull together all of this information and make sure that his family has copies of it and that it ends up in some repository, a library, or maybe the 8th Army Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, or some possibly multiple places, maybe the Minnesota History Museum.
Do you feel that you've completed all the possible research that you can do, and you're into the writing? Which, do you have a timetable for the writing? Is it two-part question?
You know, I've really taken it as far as I feel I'm able to. I could certainly do more, but I feel it's a project that I would like to finish with what I've got. So now I've written the stories. It's kind of a series of stories that are threaded together, and what I'm doing now is going back and documenting the sources for all of it, because although I'm not a historian and this is not meant to be a historical document, I want to be sure that I'm as accurate as possible. And since I've had so much information coming from so many different places, I want to be sure that I remembered it correctly as I've written it.
And many of the journals that you might place this in do want to see attribution and everything. Sure. Do you have the timetable for when you expect to wrap it up?
I'm hesitant to offer a timetable, because every time I set an informal timetable with myself, something happens in my life, some major event happens, and I end up not making the deadline. So I would say within this year I would like to do it.
Are you also, in addition to everything that we've talked about, other than the writing groups that we'll get to, is you've also been an activist or a lobbyist in behalf of the Peace Corps and other organizations, haven't you?
Never a lobbyist, an advocate.
An advocate, okay.
An advocate. Yes, I've advocated for Peace Corps, and that got me back involved with the Peace Corps community. I had gone to a 35th reunion of the Peace Corps, and you'd have to do the math to figure out what year that was. It was in the 1990s. And I became very interested once I was back together with about 1,500 other former Peace Corps volunteers, only one or two of whom I knew. And it was very energizing to be in that group, and I wanted to continue to stay involved and also help Peace Corps continue to thrive and be the wonderful organization that it is. So I began going to Advocacy Day, which is always the week in which the 1st of March falls, because that's when the Peace Corps legislation was signed. And so I have visited my elected officials and sometimes others when they haven't had enough folks to spread out and cover every office. I've been on Capitol Hill for a day, just going in and talking about the importance of Peace Corps and the foreign affairs budget, what that means, and requesting that they think about making sure that there is robust funding. And in addition to that, now that I'm involved with the board of the Mid-Hudson Library System, and which makes me very happy because I'm a lover of libraries and a heavy user of libraries, I have been going this year and last year to Albany. There is an advocacy day for libraries in which those people who are involved with libraries go to Albany and meet with their elected representatives to talk to them about why libraries are important and why public funding for libraries is important. This year was particularly critical to my mind because libraries are going to be very important in the census, in the upcoming census. It's going to be a place where people who don't have online access are going to go for the online access, where people who are not quite sure how to fill out the census are going to go and ask for help. And libraries really need to be positioned and able to provide the support that's going to be needed. So it was a very important year to go and stress that to our elected officials.
Back to the Peace Corps Association for one moment. During the current administration, there have been cuts to many of the New Frontier, the Great Society, or the Obamacare programs. Did you have any reaction, any resistance to advocating this time for the Peace Corps?
You know, Peace Corps is generally regarded as a nonpartisan program. Most of the places, most of the offices that I've been in, people are very receptive. They understand. They know it's a good thing. Many of the members of Congress and senators know people. They have family members, friends, constituents, and they know people who serve. They understand what it's all about. They understand why it's important as a part of our diplomacy and getting along in the world, and why it's important to be helping folks in other parts of the world.
Now, your work with the Mid-Hudson Library was directly responsible for you getting involved with all these ragtag writing groups I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Tell the audience about that story.
I don't know how interesting this story is, but I was at the Mahopac Library for a meeting of the Mid-Hudson Library System Board, and I walked into a room that was being set up for a meeting, which I thought was the right room, and it ended up being Vind Aquino, who is the founder and the leader of the Mahopac Writers Group. And I started to walk out, but he started pitching the Writers Group, and I must have expressed some interest, probably just being polite. But the more he pitched it, the more I thought about it. And several weeks, maybe about 2 months later, I decided I would give it a try, and that was last summer. And I really liked what I encountered. I liked the people. I thought it was a wonderful atmosphere, very interesting, a lot of bright folks, some published, some aspiring to publish, and a lot of good writing.
And since then, you've gotten involved in the monthly luncheon, two poetry workshops, a morning
yes.
thing, the Valley Writers Group.
There's this poet guy that got me involved in the poetry groups. I consider myself a nonfiction writer, but somehow this person named John McMullen got me involved in trying to write some poetry.
And you're a superb poet, so I wouldn't worry about that. What's next for you?
What's next for me really is to finish the project that I'm working on right now about Bill Johnson, the World War II pilot. And then I would just like to try and experiment and do other kinds of writing. You know, I have never really thought of myself as a writer, and one of my kids, who is an actor and a writer, it has always given me wonderful feedback. And I was talking with him must have been around Christmas time, and I said to him something to the effect of, well, I'm not really a writer. And he said to me, well, then stop writing. And I realized, I don't want to stop writing. And he said, well, then you're a writer. So I guess I am. And I want to just
And all the
explore
response,
it.
Not only from me, but from other people, has been very positive. People that hear writers all the time, like Bill Bushell at the Hudson Valley Writers Center, Vinnie D'Aquino, people like that have been around writers for years. So you should certainly take that as a positive review of your writing. My gosh.
Well, I started writing for the purpose of writing about my pilot, as I think of him. Most of the writing that I've done that hasn't been related to that has been out of just personal experience, things that have moved me or in one way or another, either grief or joy or silliness or any one of a number of things. And I've really enjoyed doing it. I feel like I'm still trying it out. I feel like a bird that's fledging and still spreading my wings and figuring out how to do things and what I like to do.
That's one of the amazing things about that group, and I think particularly with the women, because we've heard widows talking about their death. We've heard mothers talking about children with narcotics problems, and it's just been people have reached down and they're willing to share it with these other people. And as Vinnie points out, it's because it's a receptive audience, and people they're talking about the quality of the writing even more than the subjects being written about. But I just think it's a very trusting atmosphere.
It's a very supportive group, and I think anyone who has tried to write or is thinking of trying to write should find a writer's group to be part of, because writers, I've found, tend to be very generous and supportive, and you can learn a lot and hear a lot of good writing at the same time.
We've touched a lot the basis tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
Oh, I can't think of a thing. I like to cook. I can't think of any. I mean, I think we've touched on just about every single base. I'm involved working with a group of folks who, like me, are getting older, and we're thinking about what would it be like if we stay in our own homes, and what kind of supports would be needed that don't exist or could be amplified. And so we're looking at things like that. And I'm just interested. I love to travel, as I think I mentioned before, and I still do as much of that as I can. I'm still active with Peace Corps, and I love to sing with the Taconic Chorale, in addition to all the writing.
The sing, the writing, the volunteer work, and the many meetings that we attend, and you attend others, how do you keep it all going, and how do you allocate your time?
I'm not very good at that. I find that I do what I want when I want to. I'm extremely undisciplined. So I just jump in and do the thing that I feel like doing at that particular moment. But I do keep a calendar, which is now in my phone, and I'm figuring out how to have a non-paper calendar. That seems to be keeping me a little bit better on track.
Normally,
and I hike.
It works on a tablet even than on a phone, because it's just a bigger format. But that works.
I write on my computer, so I'm normally writing at home. But I do when I travel. I don't use a tablet anymore. I do everything on my phone. I have a Kindle app on my phone. I work on Excel spreadsheets on my phone. I write on my phone. Edit on my phone. More editing than writing, actually. But I do write on my phone on a Word app.
Then you don't take the laptop with you on your travel?
No, I don't. Not anymore. Since the phone can do it all. It's easier, definitely easier with a laptop, but it's just one more thing to carry. So
okay.
I just do it all on my phone.
Would you take us off with another poem?
I will. It's interesting segue, because this is one that I wrote on my phone while I was sitting in an airport recently. It's kind of light, and it struck me funny, and I just felt like writing about it. So here it is. It's called Grammy Power.
And on the internet,
sorry?
You can say anything that you want to, by the way.
Oh, okay. I think this one is okay. The first time it happened, I thought it was a fluke. The second time, a coincidence. Now it's official. My homemade coffee cake passing through the airport security scanner sends the TSA into high alert. My backpack bumbles along the conveyor, hesitates, moves forward a little, and then back. Blue latex gloves arrest its progress, then summon me to explain its contents. Is it the cream cheese, butter, cinnamon, cocoa, or pecans? Maybe it's bun shape or density. Should I offer the gloves a slice? I'll consult with my grandkids, who await the coffee cake's arrival in the Twin Cities. Perhaps next time I'll try out my lemon yogurt cake on the TSA, or maybe my flourless chocolate cake. Who Who knows what power lurks in this old Grammy's hands?
I like that. I thought it was going to be the other one about no pilot, but that's fine.
Oh, that's not a poem. And that's a longer piece, I think, John, than we have time for.
We have a caller on. Let me see who the caller is. Who's calling from the 718 area code?
My name is Jim Hart. How are you?
Hello, Jim. Do you have the question for Priscilla?
No, I was calling to listen and to see if at the end of the show you allow other people to read poems.
If you'd like to read one right now, go ahead. But I don't usually do this, so go ahead.
Okay, this is called Motherlode. She reads the telegram, bearing the weight of its words in two hands. A single sheet of paper heavier than Atlas could support. She need read no further than, it is with the deepest regret. In fact, she knew upon seeing the emboldened eagle top of lead ahead embossed that John, her only son, was gone. It is with the deepest regret, she read out loud, making the words come true, making them her own, not merely some dictated statement of fact, making them somehow heavier, riding on air. Her hands fell to her sides. Her sides were somehow seated in the old porch swing, its rusty chains echoing the weeping of her heart. It is with the deepest regret, deepest regret, deepest regret, the swing repeated over and over until darkness robbed the words from the page by her side, the words she never spoke again.
That ties so into to Priscilla's story on the World War II pilot. How did you happen to know about this, us being here and anything about
poetry? I see the message on Facebook, and it said call and listen in and join us on the air. I hold on-air participation to near the end of my conversation with the guest, and I figured I would call in.
Fine. Priscilla, do you have any comments?
I thought that was a beautiful piece. I really did. It resonated with me, and there it was so real. It was so direct. It was so. It really brought me into the moment. And the piece, the part that resonated with me was how she repeated the words, and they became real, because I remember when my mom called me in the middle of the night to tell me that my dad had just dropped dead. I offered to help call my siblings, and she said, no, I want to call everyone because I have to say it over and over again until that'll help it become real. I mean, that really resonated with me when that those particular lines. But and also, I love the swing, repeating it as it swings. I mean, there was a lot to love in the poem, and I'd love to read it. I hope that you're involved in writing on a regular basis.
I am. I have two poetry books out and two noir detective novels.
That's
so
wonderful.
I do write, yes.
It sounded like it. It was a very polished piece and really, really beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Jim, why don't you send me the poem to johnmac13@gmail.com. That's johnmac13 at gmail.com. And include the bio, and perhaps we can put together a show with your poetry and with your fiction.
And it's johnmac18?
13
at gmail.com. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure, thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, and Priscilla, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Send any comments to me, people in the audience, at johnmac13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us next week at the same time. The poet and founder of the Hudson Valley Writers Center, Margaret Stever. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of previous shows. My books are available at Amazon. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. And till then, as you say, Neil, see ya. Let's go over the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling, please.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
Peaceful, easy feeling,
and I know you won't let me down.
Thank you again, Priscilla, and good night, everybody.
Thank you, John. Good night.